Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. This week, Georgia Governor Brian Kemp signed what is now one of the most restrictive abortion laws in the nation. It effectively bans most abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy, typically the time when fetal cardiac activity is first detectable. It also grants personhood to fetuses. Here's Kemp at the bill signing ceremony on Tuesday in Atlanta.
The Life Act is very simple, a declaration that all life has value, that all life matters, and that all life is worthy of protection.
Critics call the bill a flagrant attack on women's rights and dangerous to women's health, as Democratic State Senator Jen Jordan told fellow lawmakers in March.
Each of you sits here in judgment of a situation that you could never comprehend and dictate what a woman can and cannot do with her body, with her life.
Georgia is not the first state to pass such a restrictive abortion ban. All such bans, though, have been stymied in the courts. Not a single one has yet to go into effect. Supporters of these laws are hoping, though, that the cases climb all the way up to the Supreme Court. So this hour on Point, Georgia's new abortion law. Is it yet another turning point in the battle over abortion in the United States? And you can join us. What are your thoughts on Georgia's new law? Do you support it? Do you think it goes too far? Do you see this as the clearest and perhaps most successful potential challenge to Roe v. Wade? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, we'll start today in Atlanta with Stephen Fowler. He's politics reporter at Georgia Public Broadcasting. Stephen, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, Stephen, tell us, what is the thing that really differentiates Georgia's new law from other such, you know, so-called fetal heartbeat bans?
Well, the thing that separates Georgia's law is this concept of fetal personhood. Fetal personhood is a bill that other states have tried to pass separately, but this time it's paired with the so-called heartbeat ban, and it would give protections, legal and economic protections, to an unborn child from that six-week heartbeat period all the way up until birth. This would be things like a father could have to start paying child support, or parents could claim the embryo on their taxes. And so this would give a lot of rights to an unborn child from that six-week period on.
All the rights afforded to, quote unquote, a natural person.
Right.
Right. That's what's stated in the bill, including that the fetuses would be counted in statewide population counts, if I'm reading the bill correctly.
That's correct.
Okay. And so what about then potential punishments or consequences for medical providers who perform these abortions? Does the bill spell out what could happen to them?
Well, what this bill does, Meghna, is specify the penalties for the doctors who would perform these procedures past that heartbeat ban. There's actually a line in the bill that gives sort of protections and an affirmative defense against women who seek abortion. So according to the bill's language, a woman who seeks an abortion because she reasonably believed that an abortion was the only way to prevent a medical emergency would not face prosecution, but the doctors who would perform an abortion would be the ones that would face the penalties here.
I see. Now, I understand that the original version of the bill didn't contain exemptions for cases of rape and incest, but that's in there now. However, as I read it, it says that the exemptions would only be honored if the rape and incest and or incest was reported to the police.
Correct. That was added in the House committee. It was added in there, that as well as a provision for medical abortion could be performed if the fetus was deemed if the pregnancy was deemed medically futile. And so there is the exception for rape and incest. But again, there has to be this police report that has been filed in order for that to happen.
OK. So, Stephen, tell us just briefly, was it challenging for lawmakers to get this bill through the Georgia legislature and to the desk of Governor Kemp?
Well, in addition to the committee process, it passed out of the House, went to the Senate. Changes happened in the Senate, so it had to go back to the House again. And in the House, the first time the bill was passed, there were several Republican lawmakers who were conspicuously absent from the vote. They didn't vote for it. They didn't vote against it. And the final passage of the bill happened with just one more vote than the threshold needed for it to pass the House. So it wasn't a purely partisan vote. It wasn't a slam dunk, so to speak. So this was something that devoted a lot of debate and a lot of attention throughout the legislative session from lawmakers in both chambers and both sides of the aisle.
And do we have a sense as to how Georgians themselves more broadly feel about this new law?
Well, you know, Georgia is a state of many beliefs and urban areas, rural areas and things. And what you have is a very divided view of things. You have people who believe that this is another example of the state protecting life and doing things to protect unborn children. And you have people who view this as an attack on pregnant women and the rights of women in the state. So this has probably been the marquee issue that has come out of this legislative session. And looking forward to the 2020 elections, both sides of the aisle have said this will be a rallying issue to try to vote lawmakers opposed to those viewpoints out of office.
I see. Now, the law itself does not go into effect until January of 2020, and there almost certainly will be legal challenges to it. Are those legal challenges already being mounted?
Well, Meghna, in the minutes after Governor Kemp signed the bill earlier this week, the ACLU of Georgia and a coalition of other groups were outside of the Capitol saying, "We will see you in court." The lawsuit is coming. There's no exact timeline, but it will be in advance of this January 1st deadline. And the lawsuit is something that both supporters and opponents of this bill think could be something that makes its way to the Supreme Court, not because of the abortion provisions, but because of this fetal personhood concept.
Well, Stephen Fowler, politics reporter for Georgia Public Broadcasting, joining us from Atlanta. Stephen, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Well, let's turn now to Joshua Edmonds. He also joins us from Atlanta today. He's director of the Georgia Life Alliance, and as a lobbyist, he helped draft the Georgia legislation. It's called HB 481, but now, as Governor Kemp signed it, it is Georgia law. And Joshua Edmonds began his career as an aide to State Senator Renee Unterman, the Senate sponsor of the bill. Joshua Edmonds, welcome to you.
Hey, Meghna, thanks so much for having me.
It's really great to have you. So first of all, tell us, what do you think is the most significant aspect to the new Georgia law? Is it this personhood aspect?
You know, I certainly think so. And what's important to keep in mind is this policy is being crafted in the context of a culture that we're creating in Georgia on a much larger scale that is helping to create a system that supports mothers and children and families. So when we look at recognizing the personhood of a child in the womb in this bill, we're also providing, you know, tax exemptions for families to put an extra, on average, $238 in their pockets to help cover costs of pregnancy. We're also extending child support to a mother who needs support in difficult situations while pregnant. We also look at bills like the Rape Survivor Custody Act back in 2016, the foster and adoption reform that we had last year, our expanded access to health care in Georgia this year with Medicaid waivers. And you can see that we're creating this culture that wants to support and empower women and families to thrive in our state. And so that personhood element and the child support and the tax exemption elements of this bill sort of give an understroke to that idea that we support women, families, and children in this state, and we're going to continue doing things that are good for our citizens.
Okay. So because I'm looking at the bill here now, and it says specifically, I mean, it's in Section 2 right there near the top of the bill, where it says, quote, "Modern medical science, not available decades ago, demonstrates that unborn children are a class of living distinct persons, and more expansive state recognition of unborn children as persons did not exist when Planned Parenthood v. Casey and Roe v. Wade established abortion-related precedents." And then it goes on to say that the state of Georgia will recognize the benefits of providing full legal recognition to an unborn child above the minimum requirements of federal law. So why was it important to you and your fellow advocates to get this in the context of this particular bill, and as Stephen Fowler told us a little earlier, not separately as other states have tried?
That's right. And you know, when these sorts of pieces of legislation come up, it's easy to look at it as being written in a vacuum and only looking at one medical procedure or one political issue. But when you can write into the bill the idea, the heartbeat behind the bill, if you will, that children in the womb are living, distinct, whole human persons, that science tells us that there is a genetically unique person at the moment of fertilization in the womb, that at 6 weeks the baby's heart is beating. When you have that sort of context that you can write into the bill, it allows our lawmakers and the public to understand the reasons why we're taking these steps that go beyond the bare minimum that we're required to by the Supreme Court and the Constitution to protect and have a compelling interest to protect life in our state.
Now, so it's because of this, the personhood aspect of the law, that a lot of people, critics of the bill and observers of abortion laws in general, are saying it raises a lot of questions and concerns and confusion as well. So, Joshua, if I could, I'd love to go through a bunch of them with you. We'll tackle a couple of issues before we have to take a quick break, but then when we come back, I want to dig in more. So, first of all, I mean, even though the following isn't explicitly stated in the bill, there are some potential issues that could arise when the state is recognizing fetuses as natural persons. So, for example, people have wondered, will Georgia, as of January 2020, be unlawfully incarcerating fetuses with pregnant women who are currently in Georgia jails and prisons?
That's a great question. You know, we actually had a piece of policy this year called the Dignity for Incarcerated Women's Act that expands protections to prevent placing pregnant women who are in Georgia prisons and jails from being shackled while they're pregnant in the second or third trimester and during labor. And that sort of speaks to, again, the heartbeat behind these pieces of legislation, that we're not trying to put women and children in a situation that's more dangerous, but rather one that's safer for them. So, you know, we're not going to be imprisoning children in the womb. We are actually creating a culture that is more protective for women and children.
But I am confused about that because the fetus itself didn't commit a crime, but it is being deprived of liberty because it and its mother are in jail. I mean, so you see, I want to explore more of these, of these complications when we come back. So we are talking about Georgia's new abortion law. Joshua Edmonds joins us. He is director of the Georgia Life Alliance. When we come back in a few minutes, we'll hear from the president and CEO of Planned Parenthood Southeast. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about Georgia's new abortion law. It is one of the most restrictive abortion laws in the country. And we're joined today by Joshua Edmonds. He's director of Georgia Life Alliance. He's with us from Atlanta, Georgia. And Mr. Edmonds, if I could just pick up on sort of getting some clarification from you, because there has been a lot of there questions and perhaps even confusion over the implications of the law. And I really appreciate your insight into these things. So the law says specifically that the state of Georgia will affirm that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property except by due process of the law, and that the state of Georgia will recognize unborn children as natural persons. So to pick up where we left off, if a woman is pregnant and incarcerated in a Georgia jail, what should be done to grant the fetus its liberty or its due process because it didn't commit the crime that the woman's being incarcerated for. Joshua Edmonds, are you there? Well, we will try to get that line back up from Atlanta, Georgia. Let's see if we can go to some calls while we try to fix that problem. Let's go to Marty, who's calling from Richmond, Virginia. Marty, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead.
I think that's a pretty facetious argument about a pregnant woman being incarcerated and arguing over the innocence of her unborn child being incarcerated along with her. There's no place that no other place a child can be other than inside the mother at that point. So the child's not incarcerated other than being incarcerated in the womb. I mean, I understand the argument that you're trying to make, but it's just a silly argument.
Well, okay, Marty, I appreciate that. It's just the first of a several series of questions that I have for Joshua Edmonds, and it looks like we have him back now. Joshua Edmonds, are you back with us?
Yeah, sorry about that. We're having some technical difficulties.
It's quite all right. It's the bane of our existence here. So go ahead. And did you hear my question about just a further explanation about this question of incarcerated women? Now, our caller just said it's a facetious argument, and I take his point. But it's sort of the first question in a bunch of clarifications I'm hoping to get from you. But I wanted to give you a chance to respond.
Sure. I didn't hear the second part of your question when we came back from break.
Oh, okay. Well, I was just pointing out that the law itself states that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property except by due process of the law. And so by recognizing fetuses as natural persons, they have the right to due process and liberty as well. So I just wanted to get your follow-up on some legal scholars have asked about, you know, what does this mean about incarcerated women and the fetuses they're carrying in jail?
Sure. And like I mentioned before, we're creating a system in Georgia that's more protective for women and children. And that's a really great academic question about, you know, the idea of liberty and due process for children in the womb. And while a child in the womb could not be removed from the jail cell without his mother being removed, we are creating a system which is more protective for mothers and children in Georgia prisons and jails and throughout the rest of our state.
Yeah, point taken. So it is rather an academic one. Let me get down to one that's sort of more nitty gritty and real. Because a lot of folks are wondering if the law would apply to women who self-terminate their pregnancies. For example, say a woman takes a pregnancy test at like 6 to 8 weeks, not unusual at all. The test returns positive and she doesn't or isn't able to go to a doctor. If I understand correctly, only half of Georgia counties have an OBGYN. And then she takes a drug like misoprostol, which is an abortion-inducing drug that you can get over the internet, and she self-terminates that pregnancy. Did she just commit a crime?
So the language of our law actually gives an affirmative defense to mothers. There's also code section that's been longstanding in Georgia that says that a mother can't be prosecuted in the instance of an abortion. And so you wouldn't see that happening under Georgia's Life Act.
Okay. The mother can't be prosecuted. But in 2015, Georgia prosecutors did prosecute Kenlicia Jones they subjected her to similar treatment. Is the difference there that in her case she tried to induce abortion after 20 weeks?
If I'm not mistaken, the Kenlicia Jones case, I believe the prosecution was a result of the fact that she obtained that medication illegally. She broke a different law, not an abortion law.
Okay. Now, what about if a woman is, say, 10 weeks pregnant? So definitely fetal cardiac activity could be detected then. But she had only found out she was pregnant via a pregnancy test a couple of weeks before that, before her first medical visit. But one day she starts to bleed profusely. She might be miscarrying, but an emergency room physician can't be sure if she self-terminated. I mean, what is a doctor supposed to do in those cases?
You know, that's such a sensitive situation that we wanted to be very cognizant of. My family suffered loss in the womb as well, and so we're very sensitive to the difficult situations that families go through suffering from miscarriages. We have a provision in this bill, lines 91 through 94, that actually specifically exempt an ectopic pregnancy or a miscarriage from being defined as an abortion. And there's also a lot of language built into this legislation, and it was discussed a lot in committee, that gives gives our medical community, who is, we're so proud of our doctors and our OBGYNs and our nurses in Georgia, and we trust them to take care of our patients. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of language built in that allows doctors to provide best medical care, best practices, and to use their best medical judgment to care for their patients. And so when a doctor is treating a patient who is bleeding during pregnancy, they're not going to be hunted down by some prosecution who wants to penalize them for caring for their patients. And it's written right into the bill that we're not trying to inhibit a doctor's ability to care for a woman who is miscarrying, but rather that we're exempting that so that they can provide the best medical care possible for our women and families.
Okay. So what happens then if a Georgia woman tries to leave the state to obtain an abortion? Is she committing a crime under this law?
Not under this law. If the state she goes to has a different law, she would be subject to that law. But there's nothing in this law or any other code section in Georgia that would prohibit any citizen of Georgia from seeking a medical procedure or medical care outside of our state.
Okay. No, this is really helpful because, as you know, there has been a lot of reporting on, you know, what could be as a result of this law. So you're saying that all of these questions, none of them would apply. And it's exactly the opposite of what's been reported in several other media outlets.
That's correct. I read the article I think you're referring to, and the implications in that article are not accurate. There's never going to be a prosecution for a woman who has a miscarriage or for a doctor who cares for a woman who is miscarrying in Georgia under this law or any law. And if anyone introduced that kind of legislation in Georgia, I promise you I'd be the first one at the Capitol fighting.
But to be specific, could there be prosecution for a woman who self-terminates her pregnancy after 6 weeks?
No, ma'am, not under this law or any other law in Georgia.
Okay. Now, what about this one? This is one that I sort of dug up as I was reading through the text of the bill. The law states that health records shall be available to the district attorney of the judicial court in which the hospital or health facility is located, where the act of abortion occurs, or the woman upon whom the abortion is performed resides. Is that potentially in violation of federal health information privacy rules?
It is not, and that was a conversation we had with our law enforcement and attorneys and judges here in Georgia to make sure that nothing we did would violate any HIPAA requirements. So that is in keeping with HIPAA. If there was ever a request made by a local district attorney for health records, they would be treated the same as any other request. So HIPAA information would be protected. What that's in there for is if there was a prosecution against a medical facility who was suspected of violating this act or another act in this code section, it would allow the district attorney to have access to those medical records to verify whether or not the information being provided is accurate based off of the redacted HIPAA-compliant records.
Okay, so because HIPAA says generally that law enforcement can request already medical information directly from a covered entity, as it calls it, from a healthcare provider or a facility when a suspected crime may have been committed. But that provider or facility has the option to refuse the request. Does that option to refuse the request remain in Georgia in light of the new law?
It does, and it would be pending the results of any court case or prosecution pending. And like you mentioned, the bare minimum actually at the federal level is to allow law enforcement access to those records. That was in the original language of our bill, and we actually made it more strict by limiting it down to district attorneys, not just law enforcement. So we've actually gone above the federal minimum requirement on HIPAA to protect requests of health records in those jurisdictions to only be district attorneys under this act.
All right. Well, let's go to a caller really quickly. Let's go to Mary, who's calling from Commerce Township, Michigan. Mary, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My comment or my question to Mr. Edmonds pertains to if a Georgia woman, a pregnant Georgia woman, smokes, drinks, or ingests something that is known to be harmful to the fetus that is now going to be recognized as a person, is she going to be charged with anything, neglect or reckless endangerment? I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Joshua Edmonds, go ahead.
That's a great question. Actually, the current law and policy in Georgia, actually through our Department of Human Services and DFACS, the Division for Family and Children's Services, would already take a situation where a mother who did who took some sort of substance that was harmful to the child and open up a case for child welfare. There was actually a case recently in my hometown of someone who had been using an illegal substance while pregnant, and the child was born addicted to that substance. And DFACS got involved and actually ended up removing children from her home because DFACS has a very strict scrutiny on protecting children in our state. So that wouldn't be covered specifically under this bill. It's already handled by DFACS in the state of Georgia.
Mm. Well, Joshua Edmonds, hang on here for just a moment because I do want to bring into the conversation Stacey Fox. She's with us from Montgomery, Alabama. She's president and CEO of Planned Parenthood Southeast, usually based in Atlanta. And it covers Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi. Stacey Fox, welcome to you.
Hi, Magna. Thanks for having me on today.
So you've been listening to Joshua Edmonds outline all the reasons why he thinks people shouldn't be worried about the potential implications of Georgia's new law for women. What's your response to what he's saying?
Magna, I would say that the implications of this bill are not yet known. I don't think we can conjecture on what a DA might try if this bill takes effect. But what I do know is this would have life or death consequences for women. It would criminalize doctors, and it would worsen Georgia's already abysmal health outcomes.
So tell us more about that. Why do you think that?
Well, I mean, let's get one thing straight. HB 481 is an all-out abortion ban, and instead of focusing on the real health crisis that we have in Georgia, we've been using women as political pawns during this legislative session by passing this bill in a race to the Supreme Court in an effort to gain votes next fall. You know, as you mentioned earlier, Magna, Georgia has only half of our counties have OBGYNs available to them, and we have one of the worst maternal health outcomes in the country. And a CDC report that was just issued yesterday says 3 out of 5 deaths related to pregnancy are preventable. And we didn't do anything about that this session. We haven't done anything about that in years, and the problem's only getting worse. And instead of expanding access to care, we're restricting it.
Mm. Stacey Fox, are you concerned that this bill as it's constructed, and specifically, I mean, I hear your concerns about the immediate impact it's going to have on women who are pregnant now or could become pregnant in the near future. But do you see this as going potentially to the Supreme Court?
Well, Magna, there are already more than a dozen anti-abortion cases working their way through the courts, including a method ban from here in Alabama that's literally on the desk of the Supreme Court. We're waiting on the Supreme Court to decide whether or not they will take that method ban case up. And if they don't, the state of Alabama will owe the ACLU $2 million in legal fees. Georgia literally cannot afford this litigation, and it shouldn't be wasting taxpayer dollars in an effort that the bill sponsors and the others that supported the bill blatantly said that they knew was unconstitutional. And I think that's the bottom line here. This is not about women's health, but this is about a political game.
Joshua Edmonds, is this about politics?
Absolutely not. Like we mentioned at the top of the hour, if we look at the language of the bill, this is about building a culture that respects life and protects women and children in our state. And it's important to bring up the idea of maternal mortality rates in Georgia because there is a crisis in our state and we do need to do more. And like Stacey mentioned, there is a lot of work that can be done. If you look at the 5 of the 10 worst Georgia counties for maternal mortality, Fulton, DeKalb, Gwinnett, Clayton, and Cobb, those counties are suffering terrible maternal mortality rates, but they also have the highest rates of abortion in our state. And there's plenty of health care in those counties, but there's more that needs to be done to provide high care and education and birth options for women. That's why we're working on things like expansion of Medicaid waivers. And next year, we're going to be looking at expanding birth options with providing more access to midwives to provide care in our state for different demographics and communities who want different options. Or who don't have access to a local hospital. So there's a lot that needs to be done, and certainly with maternal mortality. And it's not about politics. It's about creating a culture that protects women and children.
And Stacey Fox, what do you think about that?
Well, Magna, I think the culture piece is interesting. I mean, the governor has not yet signed the anti-shackling bill, and we have yet to see what the governor is actually going to do with his power to around this Medicaid waiver issue. You know, women right now don't even have maternal health coverage for more than a few weeks after labor and delivery in the state of Georgia. We have hospitals that aren't equipped to deal with obstetric emergencies. You know, and time and time again, it's been proven that restricting access to health care, including safe and legal abortion, leads to worse health outcomes, not better. When the 20-week ban was implemented in the state of Georgia, we've only seen maternal health outcomes worsen from them. From then, not get better.
Well, I want to sneak in one quick call before we have to take a break. Let's go to Lynn, who's calling from Terryville, Connecticut. Lynn, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. Two quick things. One is a fetus in the womb has the same freedom, whether its mother is in Tuscany or in prison. The other issue is that I just, as a libertarian myself, so I you know, that's where I'm coming from. I think that it's interesting to me that people of faith using science to protect life as they see it is sort of poo-pooed by people who use science sort of against them on things like climate change. And that's my comment.
Okay, Lynn, thank you so much for your call. Stacey Fox, and would you like to respond to what Lynn's saying?
Well, I think, you know, we are focused on science, Magna, and I think the science and all the evidence proves that when we, as I mentioned before, expand access to care, women's health gets better. And that's what we wished that our lawmakers had focused on this session, was doing more to increase access to health care rather than restricting it.
Well, Stacey Fox and Joshua Edmonds, stand by here. We have to take a quick break. We are talking about Georgia's new abortion law. It doesn't go into effect until January 2020, but it's being called already one of the most restrictive abortion laws in the country. And overall, as states try to pass these so-called fetal heartbeat bills, the question is, what will happen at the level of the United States Supreme Court? We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about Georgia's new abortion law, and Joshua Edmonds joins us. He's director of Georgia Life Alliance. Stacey Fox is also with us. She's president and CEO of Planned Parenthood Southeast. Let's turn now to our callers. Elizabeth is calling from New Bedford, Massachusetts. Elizabeth, you're on the air.
Hi. I've been an OB nurse for 30 years, and let me make clear first that I'm definitely pro-choice. My problem with these laws is that you're giving personhood to fetuses unless they were the product of rape or incest or the mother's life is in danger. So some fetuses have personhood status and some don't, which is a little hypocritical. I mean, when you want to talk about abortion, you're either all in or you're not. That's my comment.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for your call. Joshua Edmonds, would you like to respond to her?
Absolutely. And when you look at the idea of personhood in the womb, she's absolutely right. There's no difference biologically or genetically from a child conceived in rape or a child not. There's no difference between a child with a poor prenatal diagnosis or one not. Every child conceived, every child at the moment of fertilization is a whole living, genetic, unique person. And while we wholeheartedly ascribe to that belief and that science tells us that to be a fact. This law was drafted and went through the committee process in our legislature, and the end result was language that our lawmakers thought was a balanced approach to looking at the difficult circumstances that women find themselves in and balancing that with the undeniable truth about life in the womb and protecting those lives and protecting those women's welfare.
Well, Joshua Edmonds, just to be clear on something, science does not say it's a person. Science says it's a fetus or fetal tissue with, yes, unique chromosomal combination, but science has no opinion on the personhood of the fetus in the womb.
Personhood is a philosophical argument and a legal argument. You're accurate. Science does tell us that there is no biological or genetic difference between that child at the moment of fertilization and the child who was a newborn at home.
Mm. Well, let's go to Anna, who's calling from Richmond, Virginia. Anna, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I am calling for two reasons. I would love to know from Stacy at what point she believes that a fetus becomes a person. I know that at the end of life, someone is declared dead when their brain waves have stopped functioning and they no longer have a heartbeat. So I was wondering if she would apply that same logic to a fetus in a mother's womb, if that's how we declare death, if we would declare life through the heartbeat and the brain waves.
Anna, thank you for your call. Stacy Fox, would you like to respond?
Sure. Thanks, Magnet. I mean, I think, you know, what we saw during this legislative session was the medical community come out united against this bill. The Association of Medical Providers, OBGYNs, medical students came out, spoke time and time again against this bill. And I think the bottom line is, Magna, that this is a healthcare issue and a patient's health should drive important medical decisions, not a politician's beliefs. These are issues between a woman and their families and their faith and their doctors, and I'm not going to insert my opinion in that decision. I may have my own opinion, and I have a right to that, but you know, in response to the caller's question, that's a decision that needs to be made between a patient and her doctor, not between a patient, her doctor, and her lawmaker.
Mm. Joshua Edmonds, I actually want to circle back to something that we were talking about 15 or 20 minutes ago, about whether or not prosecutors could press charges against women who self-terminate their pregnancies in Georgia. And you said that they couldn't under this law. But just to clarify something, in 2015, Georgia prosecutors did charge Kenlicia Jones, who self-terminated her pregnancy. They charged her with malice murder. That charge didn't stand, and they could have charged her later with possession of a dangerous drug or an illegal drug. Never actually did that. But the charge that they did try to prosecute her on was malice murder. So it has been attempted in Georgia to hold women responsible for self-terminating their pregnancies. Why wouldn't it happen again under this new bill?
I'm not familiar with the details of that case. I think if you see that those charges were indeed dropped, that it was because the judicial interpretation was consistent with what the laws we've passed in Georgia have said, is that women are protected from being prosecuted for self-terminating. I'm not sure why those charges would have been brought, but as you mentioned, they were dropped.
Okay, let's go back to our phones. Catherine is calling from New Haven, Connecticut. Catherine, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My comment, I work as a physician. I take care of adults and children, and part of my responsibilities are to work in environments like the neonatal ICU of a pediatrics clinic. And my comment and question is about the tension between the ability of the state to assign personhood to a fetus in opposition to the ability of parents as it currently stands to assign personhood to a fetus. The example I think of is when infants are born extremely premature, there is a gray zone, you know, between 23, 25 weeks, where it would be reasonable for a parent to say, I do not wish for this child to be resuscitated. And that would be a reasonable medical decision because it could only impart pain and suffering with a high risk of mortality. Whereas, you know, later on, it really wouldn't be a reasonable thing for a medical provider to say, I'm just going to withhold all care from this child and let them pass away. And that is really, you know, our recognition that the parent, to a degree, assigns personhood to the fetus, and that there's a point in time where it changes, but it's not necessarily at the 6-week mark, as the way that medical providers practice now. And parents also have the right to refuse other forms of what we consider, you know, necessary or life-saving medical care in the way that physicians practice now. So I do think, you know, there's a tension between what we currently do and our country's views on parental choice and how we assign personhood. And I don't necessarily think that the state can make that ascertainment without the involvement of the parent and the choice of, you know, the mother and father or whoever the parents will be.
Well, Catherine, thank you so much for your call. Let me see if I can get one more call in here. Abby is calling from Canton, Ohio. Abby, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Just a few comments for Josh. Regarding the bill in family, my great-grandmother died from sepsis from a botched abortion, as it was noted on her death certificate in 1934, leaving behind a 3-year-old and an 18-month-old. And I'm pretty sure in the grand scheme of things that detrimentally affected my grandfather and the family unit. Because there weren't laws protecting her, why she did it, we don't know. And also a second comment, you talked about potential child, moving the child support date for fetuses at conception. Moving the date ahead does not necessitate child support being paid. In fact, I foresee it causing more violence towards women by men who don't want to be a part of the picture and who are forcibly now, you know, being held accountable for something that maybe shouldn't be there to begin with.
Abby, thank you for your call. And Joshua Edmonds, would you like to respond to her?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm so sorry to hear about the loss of your grandmother. What a terrible situation. My condolences. You know, that circumstances like that are the reasons that the language in this bill also requires that abortions that are legal in Georgia must be performed inside of a facility that is capable of taking care of a woman should those complications, which often do arise during an abortion procedure. In terms of the idea of violence against women because men don't want to pay child support. What a terrible thought that a man would do something like that. And we know that it does happen. And for that reason, we also have a law in Georgia called the Unborn Victims of Violence Act, which actually makes it a crime to try to do damage to a child in the womb by a third party, whether it's a drunk driver who causes a woman's child in the womb to die, or even if it's an intimate partner violence, which is just a reprehensible idea. So we're trying to build that culture that respects and protects life, and we've got the laws in place to help provide support to women financially and to women and children legally, and there's more that needs to be done in building up a culture where men see that it's important to take responsibility, to respect women, and take responsibility for the decisions and choices that they've made as well. So it's all part of that culture of life that we're trying to build here in Georgia.
Well, isn't the ultimate act of respecting a woman, respecting her right of sovereignty over her own body?
It's an important conversation to have because you've got the balance between this liberty for a woman to make healthcare decisions and the rights of a child to not have someone else's healthcare decisions end their life. And so when we have bills like this where we're striking that balance, it's important to understand that we're taking into account those difficult circumstances and providing for liberty and freedom for women to make healthcare decisions that are best for them, but also creating a legal atmosphere that protects children who have beating hearts in the womb.
Well, Joshua Edmonds, director of Georgia Life Alliance, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Thanks for having me.
Stacey Fox, one last question for you. You're in Montgomery, Alabama today. I'm wondering how you see Georgia's new law as affecting the South and the Southeast in general.
Yeah, Magna, you know, I think whether it's in Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi, and we work across all three states, you know, I think this question of when life begins is a deeply personal belief, and for some it's based on religion, for some it's based on science. But one thing I do know is that politicians are not the experts. And, you know, here in Alabama, we're seeing politicians try to pass an even more egregious ban on abortion than Georgia has in a state that literally is in a crisis related to its criminal justice system, and, you know, isn't focused on the real health problems. Like, for example, in Alabama, black women are dying from cervical cancer in 2019 at rates higher than any other state in the country. Cervical cancer that can be prevented by vaccine, detected by, you know, tests and cured if caught early. That's what we should be focused on. Just like in Georgia, our lawmakers, it's just so clear, and they've made it clear time and time again when they say in the press and in the walls of the capitals that they know that these are blatantly unconstitutional laws. How dare they play games with women's lives and women's health by wasting taxpayer dollars and not focusing their energy and efforts and the state dollars on the real health crisis.
Well, Stacey Fox, President and CEO of Planned Parenthood Southeast. Stacey Fox, thank you so much for joining us today.
Magna, thanks for having me on.
Well, let's now talk about really what sits atop this entire debate over Georgia's new abortion law. And that is, of course, ongoing legal efforts to overturn Roe v. Wade. And joining us now is Mary Ziegler. She's a professor at Florida State University College of Law and author of After Roe, The Lost History of the Abortion Debate. Mary Ziegler, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we've got just a couple of minutes here to explore this bigger picture, but I just wanted to ask you, do you see the inclusion of this personhood language in Georgia's law as a direct attempt to undermine Roe as a decision out of the Supreme Court?
Absolutely, although I think the heartbeat bills that have been passed that don't include personhood language are trying to accomplish the same goal. Really what you see is sort of a variety of attempts to give the Supreme Court whatever vehicle it wants if it's so inclined to overturn Roe.
I see. Now, I actually last night went back and read Justice Blackmun's entire decision in Roe just to reacquaint myself with it. And he does at a point say that if the suggestion of personhood is established, then the case for a fetus's right to life would be guaranteed specifically by the 14th Amendment. That's the thing that a lot of people keep pointing to. But then Blackmun goes on, though, and in very detailed, he looks at every portion of the Constitution in which the word person was mentioned, and he does this legal analysis of it. And he comes to the conclusion, he says, in nearly all of these instances in the Constitution, the use of the word applies only postnatally. In addition, together with the observation that throughout the major portion of the 19th century, prevailing legal abortion practices were far freer than today, it persuades the court that the word person, as used in the 14th Amendment, does not include the unborn. So is this ruling not clear on that?
It is. I think what's a complicating factor, and it often gets lost because Roe is such a central part of the debate and of our culture, that what we're talking about now in terms of overruling is not Roe itself, which has already been substantially overturned, or at least in part, but Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which takes a somewhat different attitude toward fetal personhood. There's never been explicit recognition of anything resembling personhood or fetal rights, but the court has sort of described a stronger interest that the state has in fetal life in Casey. So I think that's part of what personhood proponents in Georgia are hoping, that the court has already kind of moved away from the stronger interpretation of personhood in Roe towards something more mushy that they can work with.
Okay. But as of yet, though, every one of these bills that require the detection of fetal cardiac activity and bans abortions thereafter, all of them have been challenged in court and none of them have actually been fully enacted. So what's the basis of their failures?
Well, so this undue burden test that Planned Parenthood versus Casey put in place says that the Constitution, as the Supreme Court currently interprets it, doesn't allow a state to have the purpose or effect of placing a substantial obstacle in the path of women seeking abortion. And this was always about as murky and vague as it sounds, but we have a little bit of guidance from past Supreme Court decisions about what has counted as an undue burden. So, for example, the court has struck down laws requiring women to notify their husbands about abortion. The court in 2016 struck down laws requiring doctors to have admitting privileges or requiring abortion clinics to comply with onerous regulations that would apply to ambulatory surgical centers. And it goes without saying, right, that it's less of a burden to notify your husband than to be completely prohibited from having any abortion after 6 weeks, right? Mm. So as the law currently stands, heartbeat laws are pretty obviously unconstitutional, and I don't think that that's lost on the people who are promoting these laws because they believe that they have a court that will be amenable to overturning Roe, and they're looking for a way to do that as soon as they can.
Right. So, Mary Ziegler, we have about 30 seconds left. I mean, talk about that more. Is the current makeup of the court one of the reasons why we're seeing such a push from many states on these types of bills?
It absolutely is, and I think there's also been a political shift because there's a very real possibility that the Supreme Court isn't ready yet to overturn Roe, and that especially Chief Justice Roberts wouldn't go so far as to uphold a heartbeat bill. So I think that Governor Kemp and politicians like him also think that they will prevail at the polls by supporting a bill like this, regardless of its fate in court. And I think we owe some of that to Donald Trump, who's shown, at least he thinks, that rallying your base can pay off as much on election day as appealing to people in the middle who might not be as excited or might, in fact, be strongly opposed to a bill like this.
Well, Mary Ziegler, professor at Florida State University College of Law and author of After Roe, The Lost History of the Abortion Debate, and also of Abortion in America, The Legal History of Roe v. Wade to the Present. That's forthcoming. Professor Ziegler, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.